We're going to have a straight look at economic development in South Korea. And our speaker, Henry Sagerman, CEO of International Investment Advisors, is one of our regulars and one of our most astute questioners. And so I was delighted when he responded to my offer to talk to this group. I would refer you to one figure on the introductory sheet, and that is, since the establishment of his firm in 1992, it has outperformed Korea's KOSPI by 368%. So I would say that the Segerman clan knows a few things that maybe the Koreans would do well to pay attention to. I'd also, at Henry's suggestion, like to change the ground rules a little bit today. We normally sort of ask people just to ask questions. Today, Henry said he would be very happy to have reactions. In other words, if you think he's wildly optimistic or pessimistic, or he encouraged you to get up and say why you think he's off base, and then he will come back and hit a home run off your hanging curve. So, with those sort of little introductory notes, I'm really delighted to introduce Henry Sagerman, who'll be talking about the roadmap to $20,000 per capita GDP in Korea. Welcome, Henry.
Thank you. Thanks, Don, and thanks to the Korea Society for inviting me here. When I was a little boy, I wanted to be an astronaut. And it was at a time when the Soviets had launched the Sputnik and Yuri Gagarin was the first man in space. President Kennedy came out with a speech where he said, I'm going to put a man on the moon in this decade. It's a pretty challenging promise at the time, given how far behind we were. But despite, you know, wars, riots, his own assassination, and so many other things that happened during the 60s. This country did put a man on the moon. In my view, that's the type of your passionate promise that really means something coming from a politician. In this day and age, you know, we're in the day and age of weapons of mass destruction that aren't actually there. I don't know whether it's more or less reliable to believe politicians' promises, but on this particular promise, the 20,000 per year per capita GDP, I want to believe President Nomu-hyun. He made this promise soon after he came to office 2 years ago, and he's repeated it several times. In fact, 3 months ago, he promised that Korea would reach 20,000 per capita GDP by 2008. So I want to take that promise seriously. If you look back over Korea's history, you really have to respect its accomplishments. 10 years after the Korean War, its GDP was at the level of Uganda. And even in the 1970s, North Korea's GDP was ahead of South Korea's. So what it was able to do by growing its own economy 10,000% since that time is a real huge accomplishment. They did it basically by copying the Japanese model and improving upon it. An iron triangle between business, government, and the banks, supplying industries with capital and growing them aggressively. It was a command economy, which has its problems, but they were successful in this growth phase. Today, however, Korea is at risk of economic stagnation. There's a real danger of countries like China and India and many other countries around the world who soon will be able to do the things that Korea has been doing successfully for half the cost, one-fourth the cost, one-tenth the cost. So the danger here is that the miracle on the Han will be mired in the muck of economic stagnation. And that's really what I want to talk about today. The government has announced two initiatives which are promising, signing 50 free trade agreements by the year 2007, and also pursuing 10 next-generation growth engine industries. These are both very positive developments. But in other areas, there's a lot of unfinished business, unfinished homework. Now, many people here know that I'm a really big fan of Korea, but I'm not really here today to repeat some of the optimistic government reports that are often presented in this forum. My goal is to talk about some of the things that are not talked about here and that the American Chamber of Commerce, AmCham, never talks about here. But I want everybody here, including my friends from government side, to take anything I say as constructive suggestions. And my thesis, basically, is that in order for Korea to remain competitive in a world which is globalizing faster and faster every day, it's going to have to make some major internal changes, which it has found difficult to make in recent years. 3 weeks ago in the Financial Times, there was an editorial, many of you may have read it, talking about Korea's quote-unquote schizophrenic attitude. And one line, one memorable line was, Korea has one foot on the accelerator and one foot on the brake. I think that's a good image. Another automotive image, if you will, I like to call regulatory overcapacity, a regulatory gridlock, where there's just too many regulators. You might get a regulation coming from one ministry which tries to, you know, approach a certain economic circumstance. It backfires, there's unwanted side effects, and another ministry comes in and promulgates a contrary set of regulations in order to counteract the problems created by the first ministry. This regulatory gridlock is a symptom that you know, we'll come back to on several occasions in this talk. First, what we should do is define our subject. What is GDP? GDP is the primary indicator of an economy's status and is the total of all a nation's goods and services. So to get to the 20,000 per capita GDP level, it's cheating if we're just going to get there because the U.S. dollar weakens or if we're just chasing the inflation rate. It really has to be a kind of quality growth that we're talking about where you know, the goods and services output warrants an increase in GDP. Obviously, mean and median salaries will increase to $20,000 per annum, but you can't get to $20,000 per capita GDP by upping salaries, you know, by government decree. It doesn't work that way. What's really needed is a quality output of goods and services and not huge inventories gathering dust on shelves, not creating make-work jobs, and not building office towers that remain empty. We all saw what happened in, you know, Dallas and Houston in the 80s. That's not the type of growth that makes any sense and gets you to where you want to be. I think you're dreaming if you think you can get to $20,000 per capita GDP any other way. Some politicians lately have used terms like wealth redistribution or decrease the gap between rich and poor. And another thing that's kind of alarming is you hear ordinary profitable business transactions attacked by politicians as speculation. I find that a little bit alarming. The humanitarian motives behind some of the terms is perfectly noble and understandable. But anybody who thinks there's any long-term possibilities from that type of approach can just look at the economic histories of the Soviet Union or Cuba or Zimbabwe to try to find some kind of support. And most importantly, while we're on that subject, Red China doesn't exist anymore. Today, China is a capitalist juggernaut, with the power to permanently disable Korea's export-dominated economic growth. Korea has prospered from exports to China and prospered from outsourcing to China, but believe me, the Chinese are going to try to figure out how to do everything themselves as quickly as they possibly can and push Korea aside in upcoming years. I think that's totally predictable. Incidentally, you know, I'm not trying to say that the Uri Party and the Democratic Labor Party are a bunch of communists or something like that. What I am saying, though, is that harboring anti-business attitudes, it's really going to be impossible to get to 20,000 per capita GDP or any kind of GDP growth with anti-business attitudes in place. I think that's just common sense. So let's start the main point, the main part of our discussion with labor-management relations. In these government slideshows that we see here, one of the bullet points almost all the time is increasing labor flexibility as a goal of the government. But honestly speaking, I don't think that's really the case. From a statutory perspective, Korea has one of the most inflexible labor management environments in the whole world. Despite the headlines about union militancy that we see in newspapers, it's not really about unions. Statistically, Korea has a very low rate of unionization. It's not about unions. What's really the issue is Korean labor law, the underlying labor law. It's been on the books for many, many years. In the fourth quarter of 1997, Korea desperately needed the IMF loan. But in exchange, the IMF demanded that Korea amend its Labor Standards Act. And at the time, the government agreed to add four conditionalities to the labor law, which would allow layoffs only in the event that companies were bankrupt or on the verge of bankruptcy. Anything else, layoffs were still going to be illegal. And those were the only changes made. And as I understand it, those are the only significant underlying changes made to the labor law. So when we see these government press releases about illegal strikes, and how they're going to stop the illegal strikes, that's not really the issue. The issue is that layoffs are illegal in Korea. I think it's the only country in the world, correct me if I'm wrong, where profitable companies are prohibited by law from downsizing. According to Lehman Brothers, thank you for helping me on the research, incidentally, approximately four companies each year are prosecuted and fined for illegal layoffs and are then required to rehire the laid-off workers. So profitable companies, the blue-chip companies, they're just too scared to do it, or they cough up these very costly early retirement packages when they really have to do it, you know, severance payments, which are quite burdensome to the bottom line. And in any negotiations between labor and management, the result of the unfair labor law is that labor in Korea has an unfair level of leverage against management in any kind of negotiation. Korean labor has so much leverage that union officials in Korea are paid out of company coffers rather than from union dues. That's the level of leverage that they have. And the long-term result of the policy and the underlying statutes is that according to the U.S. Department of Labor, average manufacturing workers received $10.28 per hour in Korea versus $7.41 in Singapore and $5.84 in Taiwan. Now, anybody who knows these things knows that Singapore and Taiwan have a much higher GDP per capita than Korea, yet manufacturing labor wages are significantly higher in Korea. As a result, productivity and competitiveness are quote-unquote rapidly eroding due to this trend of entitlement, according to the Korea International Trade Association. trying to work around this illegal layoff problem, companies in Korea have hired millions and millions of part-time workers. And now, really after about 2 or 3 years of this trend, Korea has one of the world's highest rates of part-time workers. And this workforce is a very worried workforce, which as a result of its constant neurosis, tends to add very low buying power to the Korean domestic consumption scene. Now, rather than scrap the underlying law which makes layoffs illegal, the Tripartite Commission, which is the commission composed of labor, management, and government, passed a new rule a couple of years ago, requiring employers to upgrade all part-time workers to full-time after a certain time period. So imagine you have a workforce, and a number of them are part-time, a lot of them are part-time, and you're required after a certain period to upgrade them to full-time. That's regardless of whatever deal you worked out with them. So the Korea's assembly, you know, based on this scenario with the part-time worker protection law, has descended into bickering, which has dragged on for about a year, about how long the time period has to be before the part-time workers are required by law to be upgraded to full-time. And they go on and they keep arguing. And most recently, the National Human Rights Commission has weighed in on the subject, and they have their own version of Korea's cradle to the grave labor entitlement and or employment guarantee. So I don't know where it's going to go from there, but it's an example of this regulatory gridlock where you have one law that has one effect and then new regulations meant to sort of counteract that, where really the problem is the underlying law. So my conclusion is, why not just get rid of the problematic anti-layoff law, the underlying law? It promotes overcapacity, inventory overload, margin squeeze, in short, inefficiency. That's we have a visual display here. Okay, so step number one on the roadmap is eliminate the attain labor flexibility by removing conditions to layoffs in Korea. At the end of the day, the Korean taxpayer foots the bill for this. His money is used to bail out the guarantee companies that bail out the banks that roll over the loans to companies that can't service their debt because inflexible, inefficient overstaffing has wiped out any margins for the company. Instead, why not spend taxpayer money on building a better social safety net? Currently, it's a bit stingy, I would say, in Korea. The under 30 workforce who are known to suffer chronic unemployment in Korea, if they have less than 3 years' experience, job experience, they're cut off from unemployment insurance after 90 days. So, and those are the ones who have the hardest time finding jobs. So maybe that's an area that could be addressed with tax money. Workforce re-education. Korea does have a great education system. Why not think about migrating workforce into higher value-added industries? You could migrate the manpower into some of those 10 next-generation growth engine industries like digital content, biomedical, robots, etc. You know, some really exciting new industries that the government has gotten behind, and workforce re-education is certainly a way that the workforce could get there. Now, while we're on the subject of labor, I want to talk about North Korea. To me, North Korea is not a nuclear issue, it's a labor issue. North Korea offers South Korea one of the greatest economic opportunities in the world for the next decade. It could become a vast maquiladora to the north, just like Mexico is to our south. There's a half dozen companies at the Kaesong economic zone now, and 200 to 300 standing in line to go in next. I even heard that North Korean government officials were meeting with Nokia executives in Beijing lately. So obviously Samsung Electronics should get on the bandwagon and start thinking about that, which they haven't at this point. North Koreans speak the same language as South Koreans. Like all communist countries, they have a fantastic educational system and a 99% adult literacy rate. Relative to countries as poor as North Korea, they have excellent health statistics. They're highly motivated workers, and apparently they even have cheerleaders, cute cheerleaders, and soccer hooligans, so they can't be all bad. In my view, Korea's main enemy is not North Korea, it's economic stagnation. South Korea's most powerful weapon, which could be a deterrent in its war against economic stagnation, is the North Korean workforce. North Korea is an opportunity to boost margins for South Korean companies. There's a real danger there with China, India, and other developing countries taking industry away from South Korea. North Korea can help South Korea gallop back into the lead position in Asia once again. That's step number two on my list. But the deal with North Korea really has to be done right. It can't be a handout. I would say, you know, give North Korean workers a healthy 50% raise, all-you-can-eat lunch for free, and let the government collect standard income, the North Korean government collect standard income taxes and standard charges for any utilities from state-owned enterprises, obviously. But that's it. I think that the slice that they're getting now is way too big. It really has to be a win-win scenario for the North Korean worker and for South Korean businessman, not another bribe like they paid 5 years ago. Please, I would hope that they could keep Hyundai entirely out of the process. This should be something done between governments and between businesses, with no one business controlling the whole, acting as a gatekeeper. Likewise, regulators ought to be kept at a bare minimum in this whole process. Make it be a, you know, a supply and demand type of scenario. And finally, somebody is going to have to work out a deal with President Bush so that the South Koreans can take Pentium processor PCs to North Korea. Currently, for some nonsensical reason, Pentium processors are considered to be a security violation, and it's difficult for South Korean businesses operating in North Korea to have proper computer backup for their businesses. So that's an area that needs to be worked on. These computers are not going to be used to build nuclear weapons. They're being used for household goods and electronic goods and so forth. Let's head back south again and resume our discussion of the South Korean working stiff and talk about his big debt problem of the last few years. First, I want to, you know, set the record straight. On average, Korean households have always had low debt levels. If you look at interest relative to discretionary income or total debt relative to assets or any other yardstick, Korea really doesn't look too shabby. So what is it that went wrong? How come nearly 1 in 10 Korean households is in default on its credit cards? Well, it started in 2001 when there was an effort on the part of the government and the financial institutions to try to get some sales tax that was being held up in the cash economy, a very, you know, widespread cash economy. So they came up with this idea of putting out credit cards to Korean households. But it wasn't done with very much credit analysis, and college students soon had 6 or 7 credit cards, and they were just spending like crazy. Now, these credit cards and the whole cash flow of the credit card companies was based on 30-day terms. The rest of the world doesn't use 30-day terms. It uses revolving credit lines, which is a much smoother way of paying off your credit card obligations, and it allows you as a household to stay in the domestic consumption economy while paying off your credit obligations over time. It's perfectly normal, and it's used throughout the world. I don't think there would have been a consumer slowdown in Korea had there been revolving credit lines. What's worse is that after so many households got into default situation, the government and the banks clamped down and they cut people off their credit. They wouldn't give out new credit cards to any customers. It was just basically the whole system froze up, and it caused a real slowdown in domestic consumption. So here you have an example of regulatory gridlock, where first they say go out and get credit cards, and then they say, well, stop using your credit cards, and the whole domestic economy ground to a halt as a result of these moves. Another area of consumer lending inefficiency is Korea's mortgage business. Basically, there are billions and billions of dollars of untapped assets in Korea in real estate. The loan-to-value ratio in Korean real estate, residential, is under 50%. Most OECD countries, the loan-to-value ratio is up at the 80% level. Essentially, what's happening in Korea, they have this chonse system where you rent an apartment and you prepay your rent for 2 years. So all of that money that could be used for buying homes and taking out some mortgage capital when you need it is locked up in this chonse system. Mortgage money is much more stable from a domestic consumption point of view because the lending institutions have solid collateral behind the money, unlike credit cards. And so it's really an area where the vast untapped assets could be the banks would be able to open that up. With an expanded loan-to-value ratio for Korean mortgages, and with revolving credit lines, I don't think we would have this type of domestic consumption slowdown. And if they can bring up the system to a more stable approach, such as I'm suggesting, this type of domestic consumption slowdown will be a lot less likely in the future. So that's steps 3 and 4 on this list here. So let's return to our discussion of economic stagnation by talking about one of the most destructive weapons that it uses, which is regulation. Another government slideshow bullet point that they're always talking about is deregulation, that the government is committed to free market principles. In my estimation, these types of claims are just as disingenuous as their claims about labor flexibility in Korea. If anything, Korea remains one of the most hyper-regulated countries in the world. I'll tell you a story about my experience at a company called NCSoft, which is one of Korea's most successful companies. They have the number one online gaming game in the world. It's called Lineage. It has four times as many subscribers as number two. It's just a huge phenomenon. I went to visit the company a couple years ago, and downstairs from the main office there were, inch-thick steel bars that I had to be let through, and I asked the management, well, what are these steel bars about, and they kind of shrugged it off. There were some crazy online gamers who put up the steel bars, and it didn't really, they weren't that worried about it. But what was really bothering them that day was that on the very same day, the Ministry of Information, MOIC, was telling them that their game, Lineage, could not be played by children under 12. And the same day, the Ministry of Culture was telling them that it could not be played by children under 18. So you had two different ministries at the same time trying to regulate the same Korean company. Very frustrating situation. And all the more so when it's, this kind of high-tech blue chip, NCSoft, that has gained so much respect around the world. This is kind of the norm in Korea. I want to give a few examples of regulatory overkill so that you can see how it plays out. First example is beer. Korean brewers are required by law to buy every grain of inefficiently produced barley in Korea at 300% of the international market cost for barley. The next example is TV advertising. Korean advertisers pay $7.40 for 1,000 views. That's the way that advertising companies measure the impact for primetime television airtime. Whereas in comparable countries around the world, $25 is paid for 1,000 views. This price is set by regulators at a government commission called COBACO, the Korean Broadcasting Commission. COBACO sets these rates and also chooses which advertisers get those choice, very cheap TV primetime spots. And they make their choices based on a totally opaque seniority basis. So the decision is not even made by the broadcasters in a open discussion with the advertisers. It's made by government regulators, and the price that the broadcasters get is, you know, 25% of the real price in the rest of the world. The result of this is that it stifles new companies selling new products and services, and it does harm to producers who would have more revenue to support interesting programming. These regulations impoverish a rich funding source for Korea's exciting new movie industry. To give you an example, broadcast license fees for some TV dramas are so low that the producers have to get 30 to 40% or more of their already low budgets from product placement, meaning, you know, you put a can of Coca-Cola in the screen, you're getting 30% of your production budget from that. It's like crazy. The real money is primetime television advertising spots, and the regulators are preventing it from reaching a market price. Next example, auto insurance. There are currently 21 different property and casualty insurers in Korea. That's real overcapacity. Why are there so many? The regulators impose a narrow 5% pricing band. Insurers have to seek government approval for any more drastic premium pricing change. Now, I can understand regulators preventing insurance fraud and making sure that claims are paid and that kind of thing, but this is micromanagement in my view. The next example, wireless service. Many people consider a cell phone to be a luxury. You can use a coin box or a fixed line phone. And in Korea, there are three different cell phone companies, SK Telecom, KT Freetel, and LG Telecom. But the Ministry of Communication strictly controls every aspect of wireless tariffs and even marketing. Wireless companies just have no room to breathe, even. I would say that there's a fine passed out by the Ministry of Communication on a monthly basis in Korea. And these guys have a catchy slogan for what they do, asymmetric regulation. Now, I can agree it may make sense to avoid going back to the bad old days when SK Telecom had 100% market share. But I think what's going on now is a kind of regulatory micromanagement. Next example, real estate. By most gauges, property values in Korea are quite reasonable compared to Asia and the rest of the world. But in the chic Gangnam neighborhood of Seoul, prices started going up. And the government stepped in to clamp down on these prices through a number of different measures. I don't know what advantage there is to, you know, the proletariat householder looking for an apartment to controlling the escalating prices in Gangnam, since it's a very wealthy neighborhood. I just got the impression that some, you know, 386 generation yuppies were whining and, you know, didn't want to pay such high prices to move into this trendy neighborhood. Basically, asset values that overshoot are always going to plateau or correct. And in my estimation, robust real estate values joined with an active refi market can drive GDP growth because it maximizes homeowner discretionary assets. My question is then, why interfere with the law of supply and demand? The next example, and it's kind of embarrassing, I think, is Korean newspapers. Recently, the Assembly passed the newspaper law, or the media reform law, which strictly limits the market share of some of Korea's major newspapers, Chosun Ilbo, who's here, Dong-ai Ilbo, and Jung-an Ilbo. Their market share is limited by the government now. It appeared so much to be just targeting the opposition press that the legislation came under international criticism from Reporters Without Borders. The next intrusion could actually be right in your own bedroom in Korea. Last week, regulators began looking into Korea's falling birth rate, so just get ready for them to pass some laws telling all those roving husbands to go right home after work and do the patriotic thing. All kidding aside here, obviously bona fide crimes like price fixing, collusion, restraint of trade should be prosecuted, but and also any kind of utility that operates with an absolute a monopoly, the government has an obligation to the Korean citizen to prudently guide those prices. Other than that, free market principles really are called for in Korea. I also don't want to be seen as a hypocrite here, because the U.S. government has quite a lot of protectionist laws in place and industry supports and so forth. Especially farm subsidies, I think, in this country are extremely embarrassing. But the point I am trying to make is that Korea's main enemy, economic stagnation, is sure to win if the country cannot set aside its legacy of paralyzing regulations, which harms industries and services in every sector. Around the world, hyper-regulation often goes hand in hand with protectionism. In Korea, protectionism hurts the Korean consumer because he has fewer choices, only domestic choices, and it also serves to slow economic growth because exports are depressed by retaliatory tariffs imposed on Korean goods by other countries, especially the EU. Singapore and Chile are not huge export or import markets for Korea, but the free trade agreements took about a year to negotiate with Singapore and Chile, and the Singapore agreement has not yet been signed. The government is currently negotiating free trade agreements with Japan and also the ASEAN countries. And it has announced that it intends to negotiate 50 more free trade agreements by 2007. I'm very hopeful that the government will fulfill this promise, because it will mean more of an unfettered export environment for Korea, which will be very positive for GDP growth. And the world is globalizing very quickly, so it's the more the merrier. And that's step number six. And we spent some time talking about the regulators, so I'd now like to talk briefly about the buildings that they work in. It's true that construction projects can contribute to growth in GDP per capita. Your ideal construction expenditure is a building where there's a new business, new hiring, making new higher-margin products and services, which enjoys robust bottom-line growth. But unfortunately, buildings housing regulators don't make this type of contribution to GDP growth. 2 years ago, the government announced a $45 billion plan to move the capital of Korea to the Gongju area. An NGO, non-governmental organization, promptly filed a petition, and Korea's constitutional court ruled this massive move unconstitutional. The response from the government was to come back with a new plan, which would move, instead of 18 ministries, 12 ministries to the Gongju area. But the price tag is still huge. I've heard estimates as high as $60 billion. I don't know if land has been bought quietly in advance of this move, or the voters in this area are somehow important to upcoming elections, but it does seem like a very big expense for the Korean taxpayer to pick up. Hopefully, since a new petition has been filed, the Constitutional Court will rule against this move as they did the earlier move. Even the Financial Times criticized moving the capital. I guess the viewpoint here is that Korea does not need a Brasilia. There's another undertaking which has a Brasilia overtones, and that's Korea's dream of a Northeast Asian hub. My question is, what is a Northeast Asian hub? Isn't the internet the only real hub in this quickly globalizing world? 100 years ago, you had the Industrial Revolution and colonialism. You needed these types of shipping hubs like Hong Kong and Singapore. I'm just wondering if that's really necessary right now. Perhaps Beijing needs its own deeply dredged port, but I think the Chinese would simply do this to Qingdao Harbor themselves rather than use Incheon or Busan or somewhere in Korea. The bottom line is that there's some kind of El Dorado feeling with this Northeast Asian hub. 2 weeks ago, the head of the European Union Chamber of Commerce suggested that Korea rethink the whole concept. So that's my point number seven, which is let's avoid these Brasilia concepts. Rather than declare Korea a hub, why not instead focus on some of the basics, like improving Korea's appeal as a destination for foreign direct investment? FDI. FDI boosts GDP growth because it results in new goods and services, which are often higher value-added goods and services. This is needed now more than ever. Last week, the United Nations rated Korea number 120 out of a total 140 countries in terms of attractiveness for FDI. FDI in Korea has been on a four-year slide. In order to compete with China, India, as well as many growing economies in South America and Africa, Korea will need to drastically improve the FDI environment. The government has revised its Foreign Investment Promotion Act, offering longer leases and free rent in free economic zones and grants worth 15% of your investment, but really this is not enough. The purpose of M&A, whether local or FDI related, is to streamline business, but whenever M&A is announced, it seems like the target company's workforce immediately goes on strike and refuses to cooperate with the M&A being proposed and the new management that's coming in, even if they're reasonably passive. And at the end of the day, many of these FDI deals result in some sort of no layoff ever policy coming down from the new managers, which it really defeats the purpose of M&A, which is to streamline operations. Simultaneously, sometimes what happens is there's a harsh beam coming from the regulators towards M&A companies, such as highly selective tax probes, which we've seen in recent weeks. So to cure Korea's FDI ailment, major surgery is needed on labor inflexibility as well as regulatory overkill, not to mention dealing with some of the recent eruptions of hermetism that we've seen amongst Korean politicians. So I'd like to ease up here on the government officials and turn my attention to Korean business and the action-packed subject of corporate governance. A discussion of corporate governance today immediately brings up another example of regulatory gridlock or breaking and accelerating. 2 years ago, Choi Tae-won, the head of SK Corp, was indicted for a multi-billion-dollar accounting fraud. He pled guilty and was sentenced to prison. In a few weeks from now, the government prosecutors are going to try to set a new prison term of 6 years with a new fine totaling $80 million. In spite of the fact that the government convicted Mr. Che, the government's own National Pension Corporation, as well as huge government-controlled trust companies, voted all their shares 2 years in a row to keep Che Tae-won as chairman of the board of SK Corp. So that's an example of regulatory gridlock, where you have this very heavy prosecution going on and these government entities voting for the convict to run the company. Now, corporate governance itself does not lead to GDP growth. So let's look at it another way. The two bad products of bad corporate governance, accounting fraud and value destruction, A, accounting fraud, and B, value destruction. It certainly can be said that accounting fraud and value destruction are harmful to per capita GDP growth. So let's start with point A, valued accounting fraud. Che Tae-won's defense was that he inherited the SK Global problem. For 30 years, Korea's command economy pushed its corporate sector into numerous world industries where they pursued market share aggressively. This involved the iron triangle between government, banks, and chaebols, where industrial giants were given unlimited loans with orders to plunge headfirst into as many businesses 52 weeks a year. The loans were called policy loans, and the banks actively encouraged chaebols to window dress their financial statements and speed the money through the system with little or no credit analysis. Unfortunately, after the collapse of Hanbo and Kia, and then Daewoo, which was the biggest bankruptcy in the history of the world, nobody said, okay, guys, we told you to cook your books for 30 years, stop doing that, and we're going to start over. So as a result, shareholders of chaebol cash cows are going to be hit by more accounting scandals going forward. And every time it happens, that's a body blow to the banks and to eventually to GDP growth. Possibly these upcoming class action lawsuits, which were just came into being January 1st of this year, will help lance the boil of this infected past. But it's only going to be possible if the lawsuits are sharp enough to do the job right. And what that means is that the courts are going to have to get big judgments against offending directors, collect the judgments, and pay them out to the plaintiffs. And the judgments can't be overturned. So let's move on to point B, which is value destruction. I like to use the expression NAL companies, non-core affiliates that lose money. I think it's a good acronym here. These are the defective companies born during three decades of unrestrained growth. Samsung Motors, LG Semiconductor, LG Sports, Hyundai Capital, OK Cashbag, there's tons of them out there. NAL companies are redundant, insolvent companies that are jammed mindlessly into sectors which already suffer from overcapacity. They really have nothing to do with the successful business of the chaebol cash cows and are kind of an insult to the notion of core competence. It's very difficult for the chaebols to close down these NAL companies, and the banks keep bailing them out over and over again. Rather than search for another problem is that the cash cow companies, rather than search for the best market prices, will often pay top dollar for products and services which are provided to them by NAL companies, and they use the catchphrase sister companies. So arm's length standards in making these transactions are really out the window. Thus, these NAL companies are kind of a double-edged sword. They cut into consolidated balance sheets with festering debts, and they cut into income statements of the cash cows with margin-crushing sweetheart deals. On occasion, the government tries to shut them down, like the big deal in 1998, but very often there's inertia on the part of the government to push for the close down of some of these companies. Banks often are not even permitted to think about closing some of them down. That's where you come up with the term zombie companies, the walking dead. B beyond this, bankruptcy courts sometimes will take the side not of the creditors or the shareholders, but of salaried executives at the companies. Or asset prices will be set at unreasonably high levels. These constipated bankruptcy procedures, where the courts kind of get in the way of asset disposals, led the IMF several months ago to complain that Korea's bankruptcy reform law was languishing in the assembly. So this is step number 10, which is very important, pursuing bankruptcy reform. So then the question is, what are the building blocks necessary for improving corporate governance that will stimulate GDP growth in Korea? So by way of example, let's talk about Japan, that has a per capita GDP of $24,000. We're not going to talk about the Dokdo Islands or history books, but let's talk about Nissan and Sony, which are two of the biggest companies in Asia and two of the most respected brand names in the world. For anybody who says Asian values mean companies never appoint world-class professional managers instead of insiders nominated by founding shareholders, look at Nissan and Sony, who did just that. Today, Japan is beating Korea with its commitment to world-class managers. Over the last 6 years, the government has fiddled repeatedly trying to legislate the number of outside directors on boards of directors, affiliate ownership levels, et cetera, but I think these steps are a bit too superficial, and what's needed is something from the ground up. Basically, what that means is that if you're a shareholder of a company, you have a share of ownership, and you vote for the board of directors who represents you. And that's whether you're a Korean or a foreigner. It doesn't really matter. The board of directors' job is to put together a management team that will drive up the value of the company and produce stable and positive returns. They can't have any other consideration. They can't be controlled by the founding shareholder family unless they have 51% of the stock. So what I'm saying is that we need a new shareholder culture in Korea where there's a real respect for the power of the individual shareholder who actually owns a share of ownership of the company. And if you have professional world-class managers, the first thing that's going to happen is they're not going to tolerate accounting fraud. And the second thing that's going to happen is that they will close down as rapidly as possible unproductive assets, because they have no, they are not beholden to the founding shareholder family. I'm not saying every company in Korea needs to do this. I'm just saying that Korean and foreign shareholders own these companies, and they have to just act like the owners that they are. This is the only way you're going to create any kind of accountability in Korea. And even if a company does not replace its management team, just the threat, the possibility that it can happen, will lead to accountability in the executive offices. And especially Korea's huge pension funds and the huge investment trust companies, which are in effect owned by the government, situation is not different. The managers of this money should cast every vote with the best interests of their clients in mind in order to grow the assets, not diminish them. I mean, that's their job. Their votes should no longer be locked in place, supporting founding shareholder families. In my view, installing professional world-class managers will increase GDP per capita in Korea because companies will naturally focus on higher value-added goods and services and returns to their shareholders. And installing these types of managers is surprisingly not a monumental task. That's because founding shareholders at many of these chaebols have gone to the market over and over again, diluting their stakes down to as low as 2%. The control of these companies is frequently maintained by a dense spider's web of circular shareholdings, which is bogus, basically. Hopefully, the shareholders can get together and give fraudster managers and value-destroying managers the boot, and real professionals who will focus on core competence and value creation, not value destruction, will come in. So that's all for the roadmap steps. I just want to say again how much respect I have for everything that Korea has done so far. It raised its GDP per capita so far, so fast. But the world right now is a different place. Korea needs to adapt, change, transform itself, and reinvent itself the way it has so many times in the past. That's what's necessary to maintain the astonishing pace of growth we've seen in the last 30 years, you know, for 30 years in the future. My suggestions, I hope they are all taken as constructive suggestions. I still remain a committed fan of Korea. Like JFK's man on the moon that finally happened during the Nixon administration, I really believe President Nomu-hyun's commitment to reach $20,000 per capita GDP. There's 32 months left before 2008, and all that's needed is the will to make the changes to achieve that goal. Thank you. There's no value system to the order. It just seemed the argument would work better with that order. But I do think that the labor flexibility is the hardest because the Korean workforce has become accustomed to these entitlements. And we have not yet had that moment that we had during the Reagan administration here where labor entitlements run up against a wall of resistance. And it's clear that the entitlements cannot build and build and build up to unreasonable levels.
My name is Dongman Han, Consul of the Korean Consulate. First of all, thank you very much for your comprehensive presentations. Most of the points that you have raised are very conducive to enhancing our economic strength. But I have a different point of view, in particular on the point of hub of Northeast Asia. Well, the Korean government indeed to achieve two goals. One is to make Korea a hub in Northeast Asia. The other is to become an advanced trading nation. We will try to make Korea as the hub in the Northeast Asia. That means we will make Korea a hub, not the hub. That means we compete with other cities in Northeast Asia. And also, I would like to point out the concept of a hub in the Northeast Asia. Our dream is composed of three elements in making Korea a hub in the Northeast Asia. The first, IT sectors. Second, logistics sectors. The third one and the last is the financial sectors. Of course, in terms of financial sectors, there are so many things to have something else. That means too many things remains to be done. But in terms of IT sectors, with skilled manpower and advanced IT technology, we have a very comparative advantages. Comparing to other countries. And also as for the logistics, we are dreaming to connect inter-Korean railways to China and Russia through the center of Europe. That is so-called Silk Iron. So we have a very comparative advantage in two sectors. So what do you think about these advantage points? My second comment is concerning the North Korea issue. So you mentioned that the North Korean issue is not the nuclear issue, but a labor issue. That means, are you very comfortable for the North Korean nuclear issue? That means North Korean nuclear issue would be solved in a very peaceful manner, even though we face some deadlocks in the ongoing peace process through the ceasefire talks. Thank you.
Thank you for your challenging comment. That's what I wanted. I'll try to answer each of your points. The Northeast Asian hub is a concept. will people show up for this hub? That's the question. If FDI, if the interest in FDI comes from where it is now, which is very low, up to a level where Korea is a desirable environment for a foreign investment, I think that some of the goals of the hub can be met. Whether there's a map of Asia and there's a dot on it that says this is the Northeast Asian hub and it's Korea and China is not and Japan is not, that's not really the point. The point is, and these are very valid goals, making Korea more conducive for financial investment, for logistics, cooperation between foreign companies and Korean companies, and developing Korea's IT so that it will remain and grow as a an IT magnet for the whole world. So all of those goals are totally valid. My only point is that the rhetoric behind the hub seems to be focused more on setting it up as a point on the map, which I don't think is realistic given our internet-dominated world. Obviously, some of these things like the railway to Europe are fabulous ideas, and they will contribute to Korean growth as well as to regional growth and worldwide growth. So I cannot dispute any of that. Regarding North Korea, what I said about North Korea not being a nuclear issue is that for me, from an economic perspective, I like North Korea as a labor opportunity for South Korea. There is a nuclear issue. For some reason, there's no nuclear issue with Pakistan, but there's a big nuclear issue with North Korea. I haven't figured out why, but I'm trying to deal with economic issues. I'll leave it to the politicians to deal with these political matters and these military matters. I'm very hopeful that there will be less nuclear weapons around the world going forward. Who would not hope for that? Have I answered your questions?
Hi, Sam Baker from Transnational Research. I'm wondering about the list that you outlined of problems and opportunities for South Korea to engage in, to get them past the risk of economic stagnation. What I'm wondering from your perspective as an investor, are these things sufficient to thwart South Korea's economic recovery as it goes forward in the near term? I'm wondering, can South Korea still be a vibrant economy despite these problems, or are these serious constraints in the near term?
GDP grew 4.6% last year, and may in fact grow under 4% this year. I believe that is a result of some of the problems which I outlined today. So to answer your question, the answer to your question is yes, these are problems which are leading to stagnation as we speak. And unless they are addressed and addressed in a substantial way, fixing the problems, GDP growth, it will be stunted. Clearly, things like labor management relations and deregulation will take time to address, but there is an imperative there.
The list that you gave, I'm sorry, my name is Ezra Mager, I represent the Tory funds. Hi. The list that you gave is a kind of idealized list of American capitalist virtues. Idealized in the sense that we don't always do all the things that are on your list. What is there that you might consider distinctively Korean or even distinctively Asian that the Koreans should do that doesn't follow the American model?
Koreans have a greater sense of community than Americans. And so it's much easier for the Koreans to say, let's be number one in broadband. And to accomplish that within a few years. Because the entire fabric of the economy, including the government and the population, gets behind this enormous effort to mastermind a technology and deliver it to the everybody throughout the nation with enormous enthusiasm and enjoyment, as well as profits. I think that perhaps there was a time during the Industrial Revolution or the early days of rampant American capitalism when perhaps that applied. But that's what's different with the Korean model. And when you look at things like their 10 new growth engine industries, you can be very enthusiastic.
Hi, Henry. Nick Reitenbach from Pinnacle. You mentioned early on in your speech how when Korea started moving, how they patterned themselves after the Japanese model. And we know the problems in Japan, and Korea has its own sets of problems, but the Koreans seem to be better at certain things than the Japanese and vice versa. That leads to the next question, is what are your, since you're picking stocks on a day-to-day basis, what sectors do you think are particularly interesting at this time, and what sectors might you not like in the current investment environment?
Well, the beneficiaries of any kind of IT growth or government stimulus measures to IT areas become immediately interesting. Of course, some of those stocks were chased way, way up on day one of the announcement, which often happens. So you have to be extremely careful looking at these high flyers. The service sector is very interesting because as GDP per capita grows, the average Korean citizen will want more services that he didn't have 5 years ago. So the service sector companies become interesting as investment targets. And frequently they'll be trading at single-digit PEs or low teens as opposed to 20s like some of the IT high flyers tend to move to.
Hi, Henry. I'm Leslie Norton from Barron's. Given some of the issues that you described earlier, is a hollowing out of corporate Korea a la Japan inevitable, and how quickly are we going to see it happen?
In 1998, we saw Korea go through such enormous changes, which to me proved the ability of the government and the people of Korea to adapt to new circumstances and remold the entire environment in such a way that earlier growth could resume and in fact move more quickly. And I think that's why Korea in 98 and 99 and even into 2000 had such enormous growth. This was incidentally the time of the great broadband explosion in Korea. I don't like making generalizations, and I'm not really a student of the Japanese market, but it would seem to me that especially Japan's financial system, very difficult to make some of the absolutely necessary changes, and the hollowing out and the incredible stasis of the Japanese economy is something that I don't believe can ever happen in Korea. There are threats, of course, based on a lot of these stagnation issues that we talked about, but full hollowing out and the kind of full stop inertia in Japan, I think can't happen in Korea because of the spirit of change in Korea.
Dennis Ian from Citigroup Private Bank. Henry, just factorial reaction regarding your number three and number four, that mortgage loan to value and the line of credit. Actually, Citibank in Korea was the first one who introduced a higher a percentage of loan to value on the mortgage, if it's not 80%, maybe close to 80%. Also, Citibank
And Korea was the first one introduced line of credit in mid-90s and early 90s, respectively. Local banks are following the Citibank passage. I'm pretty sure they will. I think it's just a matter of fact.
Great. If there's any local bankers here, just go to a meeting with him and copy everything they're doing, because that's the way to do it. I think that in both these areas, it's just a matter of time. To go rapidly from, I mean, I mentioned that the mortgage loan-to-value ratio was under 50%. It was, in fact, under 30% 3 years ago. So the mortgage business is definitely moving in the right direction now. In terms of revolving lines of credit, there's been a little movement. Originally, 98% of credit cards had 30-day terms, and I think now it's around 90%. So there's been some movement in that area, although they use a different term over there. It's called re-aging of loans. So it sounds like some sort of cheese process, but essentially it's the same thing.
Hi, my name is David Bros from Langshift Partners. What mistakes do investors, foreign investors in Korean equities, typically make that you see and that you think you're able to avoid?
The 800-pound elephant in Korea is consolidated financial statements. Everybody says they look at them, but so few pick stocks based on them. And very often, more so in the past than now, but certainly to a significant level now, the consolidated financial statement will tell you the secret weakness of a stock, because that's where all these NAL companies lie, and all of the weakness coming through the balance sheet are shown, assuming that the financial statements are not fraudulent. So these financial statements are released 1 month after the parent company financial statements, but it's almost like an afterthought. And I think that's an area where the deep homework pays off.
Yeah. This is an Andy Moon of Korea International Trade Association. Anyway, thank you very much for the presentation. Now, our country's total GDP is 12th largest in the world. Korea's total GDP is bigger than Russia. And also, our GDP is bigger, the total of South America. Total countries, whole country's total of South America is less than that of Korea. Mainly, the GDP growth is maintained by export in Korea. As you indicated, the last few years, basically GDP is decided by export, consumption, and investment. You mainly focused your presentation today is mainly focused on investment and consumption. How to make kind of the growth those consumption and investment in Korea, how to change environment to make a growth the investment and the consumption in Korea. But Korea, we exported just $100 million in 1964. And last year, that figure, we recorded around $250 billion. That increase means 2,500 times during last 40 years. To increase per capita $20,000 in Korea, we need, in export-wise, we need $400 billion. So to do I mean, you know, to make export $400 billion in Korea, what is your idea to have growth engine and export industry in Korea? For your kind understanding, I mean, the last during 40 years, our government and our industry, we recorded 2,500 times export. This is huge growth comparing with the countries like Japan, Asian countries, China, even if European countries. Without export, I think that we cannot attain per capita growth $20,000 per capita. So we have to, still in the near future, we have to depend on export to successfully obtain the per capita $20,000. So my question is that, what is your idea to develop new growth engines in export industry in Korea?
This is a very good question. Because Korea is an export-dominated economy, there is a connection between the volume of exports and the export growth and GDP per capita growth. But it's not a one-to-one, it's one factor, a very big factor. Clearly, development of the growth engine industries, I mentioned things like robotics and biomedical, which are a small part, but memory chips and other existing businesses are part of that growth engine industries. So stimulating these areas and making new products and higher value-added products will help build Korea from 250 billion annual exports to 400. If that's the trigger number, it may come sooner. At the same time, efficiency will lead to greater margins and more profitability, greater dividends for the Korean stock owners and Korean companies, and contribute to GDP growth. So I think it's important that in stimulating all of these export sectors, that simultaneously there be a laser-like focus on boosting margins and avoiding waste and focusing on core competence. I think that's tremendously important. Also, the goal of writing 50 free trade agreements before 2007 is a noble goal, and I'm very hopeful that they can get to that point. We've seen lots of retaliatory tariffs. We've seen Hynix, for example. The WTO imposed a 55% tariff on Hynix because it felt that the government subsidies were wrong and were unfair. Eventually the WTO removed these tariffs, but the EU is still fighting for them. So the volume getting from $250 billion to $400 billion in exports should be as smooth a process as possible, and having as many free trade agreements in place and also having these trade disputes resolved quickly and effectively will add to this and will have the positive result that we're all looking for.
As I think back to the people who started the terrific expansion in Korea, names come to mind: Nam Duck Woo, Chung Ju Young, S.K. Kim, Kim Woo Jung, Chairman Che of FKI. How do you compare the economic leaders of Korea today, and what lessons do you think they have learned from the successes and failures of those sort of previous giants of industry in Korea's earlier days?
You know, it can't be easy being those guys because they know what they have to do, and it's really difficult to do it. But if you look at the management of Samsung Electronics or Hyundai Motors, there's an enormous success factor going in there, and a willingness to go into new markets and improve their product and multiply their product. Samsung Electronics comes out with a new hand phone every 6 weeks. So some of these managers have taken the command economy, you know, growth model and brought in as much as they can corporate governance and core competence. And it's just it's a fabulous racing engine that just needs some more adjustments to get to where it needs to be. Obviously, there are others running some of the mid-sized chaebols and so forth that are plagued with problems of the past, and you know, Che Taiwan and his whole tortured history. You know, so there's plenty of baggage that needs to be dealt with at the same time.
My question has to do with the Korean discount. You know, that's historically been evident in equities, where stock market has traded, you know, below, I mean, maybe single digits, whereas other regional economies have, like Taiwan, much higher, traded much higher multiples. Could you just explain, you know, what goes into this Korean discount and what's happened in the recent past regarding it?
The brokers put together these universes of companies which show these discounts. If you look at the PE of Hong Kong or the PE of Taiwan, it's based on the universe of that particular broker. You can also go to the IBIS numbers, which are based on the entire universe, every company listed on the exchange. And especially with the market trading, KOSPI trading close to 1,000, there remains a discount. It's still the cheapest market in Asia on most days, but it's a bit less of a discount than it is when you look at these broker-created universes. I think that the perception of affiliate risk is the key reason for the discounted shares. You buy a company like SK Corp, and tomorrow there could be a billion-dollar cash infusion needed at SK Global. And you never know this. A lot of these things are hidden. Also, problems tend to escalate quickly in Korea because it's such a fast-moving market. The credit card problem expanded and expanded and expanded, and you saw companies like, great companies like LG Electronics and Samsung Electronics and Samsung SDI and Hyundai Motors having to give billions and billions and billions of dollars on a, it seemed like there was another credit card affiliate bailout every 6 or 9 months. It was just, it just kept happening. So, and I hate saying use taxpayers' money to fix these problems, but the government was chasing unpaid sales taxes with these credit card companies. And when the whole thing went haywire, I'm not sure if it was right to force LG Electronics and Samsung Electronics and Hyundai Motors to bail out Hyundai Capital, Samsung Card, and LG Card. Maybe there should have been some kind of, well, maybe the company should have been closed down, or maybe there should have been some kind of nationalization. I mean, look, this is all Monday morning quarterbacking, so don't write it down.
Wally Address, International Investment Advisors. Is it required for Korea to reach the $20,000 GDP per capita in order for it to be a developed economic status, or does it need to become a developed economic status to become a developed one?
One of the other goals of the government is becoming a developed economy. What does that mean? Most people would answer the question by saying, according to MSCI and FTSE, which have an actual category of emerging markets down here and developed markets up here. Korea and Taiwan are currently on the FTSE, that's F-T-S-E, are currently on the FTSE observation list for upgrade from emerging to developed. So that's probably something that will be happening. As for MSCI, I don't think it really has anything to do with per capita GDP. It's really an internal matter at MSCI. They have clients who pay for their service for developed data and clients who pay for their service for emerging data. If Korea is elevated from emerging to developed, they're going to lose a huge amount of business because a lot of their clients will just stop paying for the emerging data. MSCI has a mercenary reason for not upgrading Korea. They had some criteria that were met in August of last year. Korea had solved all of the requirements for upgrade to developed for MSCI. And 2 weeks after they reached that level, MSCI put out a new questionnaire, adding a whole series of new, they basically moved the goalposts on the Korea upgrade. So I don't really make an equation between the 20,000 per capita GDP goal and advanced economy. An advanced economy, it's kind of a subject, if you want it to be. I think the government has never said we want MSCI to upgrade Korea. Perhaps they should. It's just used as a general term. That's my understanding.
I like the way you sort of composed your thoughts before you answered the very good questions. I'd like to thank the audience for the questions. I was very pleased by the governmental reaction to what you laid out, and I think this occasion has been a total plus. So thank you for your presentation, and thank you for the audience for your reaction. So class dismissed.